Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to UK TV's brand new podcast, A Stab in the Dark, where once again we open the casebook on crime fiction and TV crime drama. In this episode, I'll be talking to author Anne Cleves, who created characters such as Shetland's Jimmy Perez, and author Yrsa Sigurðardóttir, who sets her stories in Iceland, the country, as opposed to the frozen food chain. And we're going to be talking about islands. Both Anne and Yrsa have set stories on wild, windy and wonderful places in the middle of the ocean. So what makes island-set stories so fascinating? Do the islands have any effect on the characters themselves? And does the island itself become a character in the stories? We'll also be hearing from both Anne and Yrsa as they give us their top picks for what to read and what to watch when it comes to unmissable crime stories. My name's Mark Billingham. Welcome to A Stab in the Dark. Welcome to you both. Let's start with you, Anne. You're well known for your other characters, Inspector Ramsay, and of course Vera Stanhope, so brilliantly played on television by the fabulous Brenda Blethyn. But I really want to talk about the Shetland series. You've released two new Jimmy Perez stories this year, the novella Too Good to Be True and the novel Cold Earth. Could you tell us a little bit about them?
Well, Too Good to Be True was a quick read, so that's for people who are adults new for reading, so you don't want to talk down to them. The content has to be grown up, but the language has to be quite simple. And that was a real challenge to write, because suddenly you're back to basics and you have to think, what story really about? You know, what do I really want to say in this? So I had great fun writing that. And yes, Cold Earth takes us back to Shetland, which I love. And it starts with a massive landslide cutting the island in half. And it sweeps through a small croft house. And in its wake, it leaves behind the body of a woman, and nobody knows who she is. Mysterious, dark-eyed, dark-haired woman in a red silk dress in February in Shetland. And of course, because we're crime writers, she wasn't killed by the landslide. She was already dead.
Of course she was. When you started the series, did you ever think it would run on as long as it did? Was that the intention?
No, it was going to be a standalone novel. My editor said to me, I really like this, but it would stretch credibility too far to have more than one book killing people off in Shetland, which has a population of about 22,000 people. A bit like Iceland, really, I suppose. That's a similar sort of idea. But we're still killing people off in Shetland.
Hey, if they can get away with it in Midsummer.
I know.
You know, I think you can get away with it on the Shetlands. So why that choice of the Shetlands then, when you wrote the first Jimmy Perez? Why the Shetlands?
Because I knew it well. I dropped out of university and got a job there cooking in a bird observatory, which was great fun, and got to know the island, got to know the islanders. And because I write quite traditional crime fiction, it's perfect for that, because there's a small enclosed communities where everybody knows each other's secrets, where outsiders are noticed and talked about. And that idea of, if a crime is committed, it must be somebody on the island who's done it, is, you know, harks back to Christie and the boat on the Nile and the train stuck in the snow. And it is just a fascinating place. I love it. I love the bleak landscape and the long horizons, and that landscape where nothing is hidden, where you can see as far as you possibly can. There are no trees in Shetland, or very few. The contrast between that and the idea of secrets and things that are hidden below the cold earth.
Yeah, well, I definitely want to talk a lot more about this idea of what an island brings to a story and the landscape and the sort of the unique setting of an island. Irsa, your new novel, which is out at the moment, called Why Did You Lie? Four strangers stranded on a kind of spike of rock off the Icelandic sea. One thing in common, they've all lied. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, this was my 10th book for grown-ups. And so I wanted to sort of make it a special edition type of thing. So I brought in three separate plot strands to make it more difficult to write and hopefully more interesting to read.
You deliberately made it more difficult for yourself.
I deliberately did that, yes. Yeah. And so it's the people on the lighthouse, and it's people coming home from abroad after doing a house swap or home swap.
Okay.
And they find that the people that they swapped with seem to have disappeared, the people that were supposed to be in their house. And then a policewoman whose husband has committed suicide for apparently no reason, she finds an old police report where he's being interviewed as a child about a suicide similar to his. So I brought these three things and then braided them together into like one story.
And this was something that you felt you could do in a standalone story better than in one of your series books?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I've written, I think, three standalone novels, and they are, there's more freedom, I guess that would be the word, because everybody's disposable, you know, every single character. So you don't have to, you know, take care or develop them in the same way and same manner as you do in a series.
Do you ever feel like doing? I often feel like winding my editor up by sending in a synopsis of the new book that starts with the main character's funeral, just to sort of see the reaction and see the angry emails you get.
I'll do that.
Yeah.
But that thing of. Sort of, do you alternate standalones with the series books? I mean, is that going to be a sort of long term?
No, I did like five books in the Thora series, and then I did a standalone, then one last one for the Thora series, and then two standalones, and now I'm on the third book of a new series, the first of which is coming out in March here in the UK. It's very hard to write something because it's expected of you, or it might be the smartest marketing thing to do. That just doesn't work for me. I have to write somehow.
I don't think it
really
writes for most writers, you, Mark?
I think if you grow tired of it, the reader will very quickly go
absolutely,
tired of it.
Yeah.
So, and you need to end a series when people still want more, I think, which is why my next book will be the last Shetland book.
Yes, I was going to ask about that.
Ooh,
last
yeah.
meaning that's it? Or is there a kind of never say never, no,
yeah,
drawing
well,
a line
I
under it?
I did do an event with Ian Rankin and he said, good luck with that.
Yes. No more Rebus.
But how many does that make, Anne?
Eight.
It will be eight at the end
when the last one's
it's
done.
It's a good round number if you're going to stop. You can't see Anne's face, but there's a mischievous smile. There's definitely a mischievous smile, so we will have to see. So just going back to the notion of islands, authors as diverse as, you know, Plato, Enid Blyton, Agatha Christie have used the isolation of an island to very good effect. And on TV too, we see it all the time, whether it's Bergerac on Jersey or more recently Death in Paradise, which can both currently be seen on Drama Channel. So what is it about an island? Why are they such popular places to set stories in, such popular places for stories from a viewer's and reader's point of view?
There's something very romantic about islands, isn't there? You see it, you come to it from a distance and you just see it as a smudge on the horizon, whether you're flying in or boating in, and then suddenly it becomes more known. So it's quite a mysterious place, but it is possible to know it quite well because it has a defined boundary. So all those things, I think, make it really interesting to write about.
It's a smallish island, though, doesn't it? I mean, you know, we live on an island, but it's a pretty big one.
Yeah.
But there has to be something a little bit geographically limited and in terms of population as well.
I think so. And it's like any remote cut-off community would probably work, that if there is a tragedy, you're likely to know the person who's or the family who are involved in a place, in a community that's small. And so it has an impact on everyone. And I think that's what I was trying to do in Cold Earth, that the landslide fractures the island by separating it, but it also fractures that sense of reassurance and community that's there beforehand.
What about you, Ursa? What do you think about setting stories on islands?
Yeah. I must say, because I'm from Iceland, it was just sort of, that's the place I know. So I said it in Iceland because that's where I'm from,
yeah.
Really. But I do think it, like Anne was describing, it does have some sort of mysterious element to it, and this you can't get away without somebody knowing. I mean, you really couldn't leave Iceland without somebody knowing that you left, unless you hide on a boat, and I don't think that's possible anymore.
They know that you've left. So if you, you fly over to the UK, there's a little sign somewhere that just goes minus one. They kind of,
Yeah, somebody has to come in, replace. No, but I mean, you know, they could trace it. Not that they follow up on everybody, but they could. They would be able to find out when you left, when you return, and so on.
And Shetland is so small that somebody that you know would have seen you get on the ferry, or you always meet people you know at the airport when you're way off or in the ferry terminal. It's like meeting of old friends when you arrive. Oh, hello, you're back.
I think until you experience that, it's very hard to actually even appreciate that stuff happens, you know, living in a big city, that it can be that small. And that,
yeah.
I used to read a lot of stuff. You know, I read Five on Craggy Island or whatever it is when I was a kid. I'd never set something on an island. Then I wrote a book set on Bardsey Island, which I know you know well, Anne. Yeah. And going there, I kind of went, oh, I get it. I mean, it is a very tiny island, but it does have a very odd atmosphere. There's loads of myth and folklore. You literally can't leave the island. I mean, it's not like people will know if you leave. You cannot leave.
Yeah.
And the other thing, of course, is it's incredibly useful from a crime writer's point of view. There's no CCTV. You can't get a mobile phone signal. All that stuff. And I really just thought, God, I wish I'd done this before. And it is very useful for a crime writer.
Oh, it is. It's a wonderful device. Yeah, and that's very true.
So, Ursi, you mentioned that you're from Iceland. And it's a place we suddenly kind of know or think we know much more about, certainly in terms of crime fiction. A lot of very, aside from yourself, a lot of emerging authors like Ragnar Jonasson, TV series like Trapped. But what is it actually like to live there? Because I think most people have a very cliched idea probably about what Iceland is. It's cold and there's geysers and they all eat rotting shark and stuff. But most people genuinely have no idea what Iceland is like.
I think it's the best place to live in the world.
Of course you do.
Yeah. But that, I mean, everybody thinks that of their home place. So that's maybe not saying much, but it is really nice. And it's not as cold as the name implies. For example, they should really swap Greenland and Iceland.
Yeah, it's greener than Greenland,
isn't it? Yeah, because Greenland was found by someone who came back and wanted everybody to think he'd found this great, magical, wonderful place. So he called it Greenland. It's totally white, covered with glaciers and snow. And Iceland, the guy who named Iceland, he had been a failed settler. And he didn't want people to know what a loser he was, so he called it Iceland to say, like, this is so horrible, even I had to leave.
It comes across as a very, sometimes a very harsh place to live in terms of the landscape. Very beautiful, very harsh. Do you think that has an effect on the Icelandic character? Is there such a typical thing as what's a typical Icelander?
A typical Icelander is pretty easygoing. And if we had like a crest or what do you call it, crest?
Yeah.
The slogan would be "Tataretast," which means, oh, don't worry, it'll be okay. Because that's how the country
no
is.
Sweat. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. It'll be fine. And that's sort of the phrase that would best describe, I think, the mentality, which does come from how hard life was up till about the 50s. After the Second World War, it became easier. We were the poorest country in Europe until that time.
But of course, you're now challenging that don't worry about it, everything will be all right idea in your fiction, because of course you're giving these characters lots of things to worry about. So, you know, how does an Icelander cope with murder? I was struck many years ago reading an Arnaldur Indridason novel, and it was a missing persons case, I think it began with, and there's a moment in the police station where one of the detectives says something like, do you know how many people go missing every year in Iceland? 7. And I thought, oh, okay, this is a very, just crime is different because
it
of the size and the population and so
is.
On.
And I was, we're 320,000 people and we have 653 cops, that's it.
Okay, what's that per head? My maths is terrible.
Not many. Don't know. Yeah, that's not very many.
What about Shetlands? How many cops in Shetland?
A couple? No. I think there's certainly a police inspector and probably a team of half a dozen maybe, and a community policeman maybe up on Unst on one of the Northern Isles. I'd have to check.
Wow.
But not very many, no.
And they're probably the same as Icelandic cops. They're not challenged much by the criminals.
No, we
have really crappy crime.
Crappy crime.
I got phoned up by a journalist who apparently Shetland is the drugs capital of Europe, she said, because people are thinking that it's easier to smuggle drugs into Shetland than anywhere else in Scotland. And there are now sniffer dogs in the ferry terminal and the airport, but I'd never seen any evidence of it.
And what about the character of a typical Shetlander, Anne? How would you define
that? I think they're really quite dynamic, and they're quite canny. They're very sensible. They're very Scandinavian, I think, more Scandinavian than Scots. So when oil was found off Shetland, the council negotiated a really good deal where they would be perfectly happy for the oil to come ashore in Shetland, but they would take a percentage of every barrel that came ashore. And all that money was put into trusts, five charitable trusts. And there was an arts trust, which is why, you know, young kids could learn music for free. They got their musical instruments for nothing. The smallest settlement has a swimming pool and a leisure centre. And, you know, so we have that amazing art centre, Mareel, on the waterfront in Lerwick, which was built with oil money. And so they're not daft. And they work really hard. They're real grafters. So fishing still earns more money for the islands than oil does. So.
Well, and how many Shetlanders generally leave the island? I mean, it's not an easy thing to do. It's not a kind of, you know, it's not something you can do at the drop of a hat, presumably. I mean,
well, there are flights.
Plan it a bit.
Yeah, flights every day down to Edinburgh or Aberdeen, but they do get disrupted by weather sometimes. You just have to allow a bit of time. Young people go south for university and college quite often. But again, because oil money has meant that the council can employ lots of people in teachers and social workers and arts workers, that people do tend to come back. It's changed a bit because there's not so much oil and the money that was on deposit in the trusts isn't earning as much interest. So suddenly life is dreadful because they can't just put up whatever they want. You know, it's a bit more limited now for money. And maybe that's a bit like Iceland too, after the banking crash.
Yeah.
Things are tighter.
Yeah, that was a difficult period.
Yeah.
And that also shows that this, you know, oh, it'll be okay. It doesn't work in banking. It's not a good way to operate a large banking system. But that has, we have recuperated quite nicely. And a lot of that has to do with the tourism industry, which has come in. It's become like a third of the economy, I think, and it was like just a tiny bit before.
Yeah, that's a bit like Shetland as well, since the oil, the Shetlanders very much welcoming a certain kind of tourist, so cultural tourism, I suppose. They have they have more festivals than you can ever dream of. So Fiddle Frenzy and blues festivals and jazz festivals, and every 2 years there's a film festival that Mark Kermode programs. And I was just up there a couple of weeks ago and it was Wool Week. So they celebrate all things knitting and spinning and dye. But literally thousands of people from America, from Australia, from Canada coming to learn Faroe Island knitting.
But I think there's a degree to which islanders embrace their isolation and have to embrace their isolation.
Yeah.
I did a book event on the Isle of Wight. I know it's not the Shetlands, but I was doing a signing in one part of the island and then an event in Douglas, right in the capital. And so some people coming along and I'm signing books in this bookshop and they go, oh, I love your books. And I'm going, great, you're coming to the event tonight. And they went, no, what event? And I said, oh, doing an event in Douglas. And they went, oh no, that's not too far. And I'm going, hang on a minute, that's the capital. And we're not talking a huge place, the Isle of Wight, but not only have they never left the island, they've never been to the capital of the island.
Ooh.
And I didn't think people like that actually still existed, but I think there are people around who go, no, this is us, this is where we live, and, you know, makes very interesting characters to write about, I think.
It does, yeah, certainly.
We talked about the unique landscape of these places, and this is a little pet theory of mine, which you can both now shoot down in flames, because I'm now going to, for the purposes of this this argument, I'm going to both include you in Scandi Noir, which is, you know, it's a bit of a catch-all term, and it's, you know,
we could be Nordic Noir.
And then we got no argument. But lots of people, when that kind of exploded a few years ago, lots of people were going, why? You know, why is it? And, you know, yes, blood looks very nice against snow and all that sort of stuff. But I'm convinced that one of the appeals of it is the sort of strangeness of it to those of us in Western Europe. Because, you know, we take our holidays, most people take their holidays in France or Spain or Italy. Northern Europe is not a part of the world we know well. And I think to see it and read about it, I mean, some people like familiarity in what they read, but I think a lot of people also like strangeness. Am I talking nonsense?
No, I don't think so. I think there is that love of vicarious travel. So I have a theory as well that we can understand a culture better by reading its popular fiction. So we do understand a bit more about, the political history of Sweden and the place in the war and through reading Henning Mankell and Jo Nesbø perhaps in Norway. So we get that sort of sense of what people's preoccupations are maybe. And that makes us feel like travellers rather than tourists.
Right.
I think part of it is also we're really experts at being like doom and gloom. That's Scandinavian mentality or Nordic mentality is this knowing to appreciate gloom.
Like, to appreciate,
yeah,
to love,
yeah,
it.
Yeah, to love it.
Well, it is dark most of the day, most of the winter, so you have to not mind the dark.
No, and have you read the Moomins? I mean, they're children's books about a depressed figure. I mean, it's really, they're excellent, they're great. And I remember I loved this as a child, and all these stories growing up about trolls and ogres that would eat you and all this, you know, it's something that's ingrained, I think, into society. And doom does have... It does fit quite well with crime fiction.
I also think there's a slightly more political element to a lot of Nordic crime fiction than you get in, certainly in British crime fiction. You know, and I get that going right back to Cheval and Valu, who, you know, they wrote political novels and used the crime novel as a way of looking at politics. I mean, is that true? Do you think generally across?
Yeah, I think the Nordic countries are also very, very preoccupied with social issues, mm-hmm. that to constantly discuss and worry about that society is, you know, not doing a good job for this group or the other and so on. So that would make sense that would come into the writing and maybe added as an element than it quite often is.
Well, more from Anne and Ursa very soon, but now we come to a regular feature in which a Stab in the Dark's roving reporter catches up with some of those who bring us the very best crime fiction. Today we hear what happened when our man with the spyglass, Paul Hirons, went along to the recent Killer Women Crime Writing Festival in London, where a number of crime writers found themselves marooned on the hipster island that is Shoreditch. Among the guests were Anne and I, as well as Paula Hawkins, Val McDermid, Martina Cole, and Shetland's very own Doogie Henschel. Here's how Paul got on.
So as Mark mentioned, I went to the very first Killer Women Crime Writing Festival held at the Shoreditch Town Hall. It was a whole day stuffed with workshops hosted by agents, publishers and authors. There were special guests like Val McDermid, Martina Cole. You certainly got your money's worth. And as I found out, like most good ideas, everything starts around a table and with a drink.
My good friend Louise Miller and I got together a glass of wine.
That's Melanie McGrath.
And we thought how nice it would be to get other women crime writers together to talk about crime writing and publishing. And here we are at the festival 18 months later.
It wasn't just Melanie behind this. She had a whole group of women around her, including the likes of Sarah Hillary, Erin Kelly, Tammy Cohen, Louise Voss and Louise Miller, who also happen to be friends with another prominent crime writer right now.
I am one of the collective, yes. From the beginning, actually, because Louise Miller is a friend and she told me about this crime writing group that was getting together, sitting around drinking wine, talking books, so that sounded perfect for me.
That was Paula Hawkins, author of the mega successful The Girl on the Train. And Paula was also part of a panel, including Louise Doughty, author of, yes, another best-selling novel, Apple Tree Yard.
I did a terrific panel about being adapted for film and television with Paula Hawkins and S.J. Watson and Alex Marwood, and it was really, really good fun.
I preferred the book. It was such a fascinating discussion. It was great to hear from the authors, including Louise, about their experiences throughout the process.
Well, I had a very lucky experience. I was an associate producer on the project. I went on set about once a week. I didn't do the adaptation myself. I think actually there should probably be a law against novelists adapting their own novels, but I really enjoyed watching the whole process from the sidelines. I think for me, you know, having been writing many years, to see people putting all that effort and working so hard into bringing the characters into life on screen was just really exciting from start to finish.
The panel's serial thrillers also examined the process that takes novels to screen. And on that panel was, I don't know, some bloke called Mark Billingham, the wonderful Anne Cleves, screenwriter Gabby Shapp, and the star of Shetland himself, Doogie Henschel. Doogie provided some excellent little anecdotes about working on the Shetland Islands. The weather often comes and goes so quickly, they only have like half an hour or 40 minutes to record scenes. So as soon as they see a belt of weather approaching, they have to get things done extremely quickly. My favourite panel of the day asked the question, is crime fiction misogynistic?
I enjoyed the panel. It was interesting. It was fascinating.
That's Irish author John Connolly.
And I was slightly nervous, to be perfectly honest, about Julie Bindle, because I'd read Julie in The Guardian and I admire her a lot, and is a debater of considerable acumen. When you're going into what you feel sometimes is like the arena with somebody who is that smart and that committed and that brave, you kind of raise your game a little bit, I think.
Alongside John and Julie, there was broadcaster Indian Knight and journalist Sam Baker, who co-created the Pool website. It was such a lively panel where the audience got involved, and there were no real conclusions except to say that there were so many grey areas in this question that you can keep debating this for hours. One of the lovely things about the Killer Women Festival was that there were loads of volunteers, including author Sarah Norton, whose debut book, Tattletale, is out soon.
Yeah, I was delighted to be involved. It was a sneaky way to come and meet lots of famous writers. It was nice to meet them and talk to people like S.J. Watson and Paula Hawkins, and that was great.
Spot on, Sarah. I can't disagree with that. And it was lovely to see everyone mucking in. And indeed, the whole idea of Killer Women Festival that started off around a table, a bunch of friends drinking wine, to hundreds of people milling around Shoreditch Town Hall, seeing all kinds of things, plus loads of big names. It was quite an achievement. And here's Mel to wrap things up.
It feels a bit surreal because it's one of those things that just started off as an idea and it's become real. And here we are in a real building, listening to all these wonderful authors, and we made it happen, and that's fantastic. It's a fantastic feeling.
The Killer Women Crime Writing Festival was sponsored by Audible. Head over to audible.co.uk/killerwomen for the first ever Killer Women short story anthology.
So that was Paul Hirons there at the Killer Women Festival. Now, the festival circuit is something the three of us are all familiar with. We could probably attend a festival a week if we weren't so busy, you know, writing books and stuff. Do you enjoy them? I mean, writing is a very solitary activity, but do you like going out and meeting readers and so on?
Oh, yeah, I do. I do.
And me, yeah. And if you get a chance to travel somewhere interesting, that's even better, isn't it? I love Iceland Noir, which is Iceland's crime festival.
Yeah, so you've been to Iceland Noir.
I went to Shetland Noir, and that was excellent. What, yeah.
And is that when you really see the similarities between the two places, or the differences?
Yes, I mean, it was my first time there, and I was very surprised at how similar everything was. I mean, there are no trees, like you say, which is very typical Icelandic. The farming seemed to be similar, not so much
very
crops.
Yeah.
And also downtown there was this insignia, like police insignia, and it said "Melögum skal land byggja," which is exactly the same as the Icelandic police. It means you build a country with laws, regulations, you know. And I don't know what language that was. I mean, was it Icelandic?
I think that was Old Norn, which is the Viking language that, again, Iceland and Shetland shares a Viking tradition.
Yeah.
And the myth is that the Vikings came to Shetland and they took all the beautiful women with them to Iceland. And that's why Icelandic women are very beautiful and Shetland women aren't.
Oh, they are. Oh, that's.
I don't know whether we want to get into this.
No. that's the story.
But they are such perfect places to set crime novels in. I mean, you know, people talk when they discuss crime fiction a lot about that sense of place and how the landscape is very important. And there couldn't be something more perfect to write about than landscapes like that.
So it is. It's absolutely perfect. And it is, I think, that open landscape contrasted with small croft kitchens, which are warm and cosy inside, and you've got the wind outside. And it's like children's stories, isn't it? We're going back to Enid Blyton and Famous Five, that if you're inside and you've got that hum of a spinning wheel because somebody's spinning, and you've got talking, and Shetland certainly has a brilliant musical tradition, so you've probably got someone playing a fiddle somewhere, and that atmosphere is right for telling stories.
Yeah.
And it's where, you know, it's where legends, and I don't know if you have myths and legends too, but in Shetland we have the trows, who are the little people who live under the ground, and the trows will lure good musicians under the ground, and they play for their parties. And when they come back, they think they've just been gone for a night.
So they're just quite short sort of booking agents, really.
Yeah.
That's all they are. They're not scary, are they? It's not
not shit.
Come here with your ukulele.
Yeah,
come down this tunnel.
But when you get back, 100 years has passed and all your family is dead.
Yeah, yes. And so. your record's dropped out of the charts.
A bit like that, yeah.
So we have
the hidden
scarier,
people.
The
hidden people, the same. Yeah, except you don't come back. They entice you by being beautiful. So you go, you know, chase them because they're so beautiful, and then they take you into the earth, and you don't come back.
All right. No, the trousers will let you go, but so much time has passed.
Oh my God! I was quite looking forward to going to these places, and now I'm a little bit scared. No. What do we got?
You
Killer
have to
clowns.
Be a brilliant, you have to be a brilliant musician, though.
Oh right, they don't take any old busker with a harmonica doing Streets of London. They're not interested.
Sorry.
Well, we've talked a lot about the islands themselves in physical terms, but there's also the metaphorical kind of islands I want to talk about a bit. The notion of, you know, prison, self-imposed displacement. Shows like Orange is the New Black and The Night Of are good recent examples, I think, of shows where we see how incarceration can have a profound social and psychological effect. Do you think there's a link between them?
Yeah, I think
it's
so.
Fine to live in a small society if you have a good reputation, but if you do something, if you, for example, you know, put in prison or something, it's quite difficult to, because you can't get away from it. Everybody will know always this bad reputation, no matter how hard you try to clean it up and so on. So that's also sort of a minus.
Yeah, you can't be anonymous in an island. No.
Right, which I think is a really interesting thing to write about. I mean, I wrote mostly about a big city where it's easy to be anonymous, where almost everybody is anonymous, which has some advantages and some disadvantages. But the idea that you can't be, where secrets are almost impossible, and you know, secrets are our bread and butter all the time. I mean, that's really interesting.
But I think in small communities, don't you think, and certainly the smaller of the Shetland Islands, because it's an archipelago and there are lots of inhabited islands, in the smaller islands, there are secrets that everybody knows but nobody talks about because you need privacy. You can't be bitching about your neighbour all the time because there will be a time when you absolutely need them. You know, I can remember being on Fair Isle, which is the small island that I know best. And one of the women had a difficult pregnancy and we had to get an ambulance flight out. So in the middle of the night, everybody on the island was out building bonfires along the airstrip so that the plane could get in. And you can't fall out with your neighbours on a place like that. So even if you dislike them intensely, you don't bitch about them too dramatically because you're going to need them.
Yeah. I'm not building a bonfire because you need to bring my lawnmower back.
Or they'd put the bonfire so the plane goes into the ocean.
Into the sea.
You do have to be, you know that you're, it is quite physically real that your survival might depend on your neighbour coming and fishing you out of the water if you've had an accident with a boat or help. Just small things like everybody in Fair Isle comes together to round up their hill sheep for clipping. And it's not something you could do on your own. So it is a very communal. So you don't fall out with people big style.
Little style, though, occasionally.
Yeah,
I mean, are there sort of little feuds
gossip
that go down through generations and stuff?
Obviously, there are people that you get on with and people you don't. But you know that if the island as a community, if you've got 50 people on a small island, they're going to have to get on. Just things like, somebody's got to turn up when the plane comes in because you need a fire engine there before it can land. So you need enough people to make a fire crew, and you need enough people to keep the roads maintained and go back to your lighthouse. You need people to man the lighthouse. So it's about really strong interdependence, which is very interesting, again, to write about.
How do you think your characters, how would Thora and Jimmy cope with prison, cope with physical, straightforward physical, obvious isolation? Would having an island mentality make you more able to deal with that kind of isolation?
Probably.
I'm not suggesting either of you should do this, by the way, that with your characters.
That'd be one way of ending the series.
No, I think, I mean, Icelandic prisons aren't really, you know, horrible places. They're not nice places. Nobody wants to go to prison, but they're not, in the way you see these prisons in America and that type of thing. They're much more relaxed and actually trying to make people better people.
Do you have the equivalent of the sort of, do you have the Reykjavik Daily Mail going, these places are like bloody holiday camps?
No,
they're not tough enough.
No, we have nothing like that. But we do have people like putting comments under, you know, because they just built a new prison. And a lot of the comments under were things like this. Of course, people think this until you have someone maybe close to you that goes to prison, then people very quickly change their mind. And our sentences aren't very tough. So, really? So for murder, you always get, 16 years, and you're out in like maybe 12 to 14. You'll be on the street again.
So there's no such thing as a life sentence?
No,
in
no, life sentence is 16 years. I don't know how
life,
they...
Yeah. Well, life doesn't always mean life anywhere else, of course, but...
I think Jimmy would hate prison. I think it would be that claustrophobia. I think if you, all you know is those very long, low horizons, just not being able to see out, not be able to see to the end would be dreadful. I think it would be horrible.
Well, also,
because
he might find himself in prison with people who he'd been instrumental in.
In putting in there.
Yeah, and that's never easy, is it? No, they always have to put those characters on kind of vulnerable prisoners units, don't they?
Yeah.
We've seen a lot on TV shows like Fortitude and Trapped, the idea that developers moving into the sort of places we've been talking about are perceived as invaders, this idea of an invasion. And even though some of the people that live on islands complain about living there, they might, you know, envy people that live anywhere else, there's a very fierce kind of tribal loyalty to the place islanders live, which you don't tend to see in you know, a metropolitan city or even in a bit of rural Britain. You don't see sort of people going, you know, I'll fight till my dying breath for the Cotswolds.
I think Shetlanders, certainly because there's a history of people coming in because of the fishing, because lots and lots of Shetlanders went to the Merchant Navy, that strangers are actually made more welcome than they are in other tight, remote communities in England, I think, because they've always needed people from outside to come in and work with them, whether it was whalers or whether it was people coming in to work the herring. So they're very used to new people, and I think they actually assimilate them much better than small enclosed communities in the mainland do.
Before we wrap up, we're going to have some recommendations from both of you in terms of stuff to watch and stuff to read. But first, just what you both have coming up in the future. What's coming next for you, Ursa?
The next book coming out in English is the first book in my new series called The Legacy, and that will be out in March.
That's the book that's nestling in my bag as
yes,
I speak.
Yeah.
We have copies of it. And that's a new series.
That's a new series that's done really well. It was nominated for the Glass Key, this one that's coming out in March. And it's now doing really well in Germany. It just came out there, and I think people like it. It has a policeman and a child psychologist working together.
Fantastic. What about you, Anne? The last Perez book.
Yeah, not for 2 years though, because I alternate with Vera. So
right.
I've got a new Vera book will be coming out next year that I'm just finishing. New series of Shetland starts filming in the spring. So if people enjoyed the show, they'll get another one of those, and new series of Vera has just stopped filming, so that'll be on in the new year.
You are queen of television. Queen of television.
I know. I think people probably follow me with knives and stick pins in my image at night. I would
Anne. I mean, it's great.
That's fantastic. And now, as promised, in each episode, we ask our guests to bring along their recommendations for a good read and a good watch. Specifically, this week, when it comes to our theme of island crime, who wants to go first? Anne, I'm pointing at you. So, Anne, what about a book that you'd recommend?
I think then for just fun and warmth in the winter, one of Andrea Camilleri's Montalbano books, because they're set in Sicily and you get a bit of politics, but mostly it's about food and good wine and sunshine.
We can't argue with that. What about something to watch?
I don't think I've got an island, but I have got translated books because we're talking about travel and translated television. And I think I was really into Spiral, the French TV show, and I've watched all those, and it's dark and it's gritty and you see a Paris that you don't see anywhere else, I think. And I really, really enjoyed Spiral.
Fantastic.
I love the characters.
A book.
I would say I would recommend Ragnar Jónasson's series.
Yes.
From I think the title of the series is Dark Iceland. And then there's a new author coming out maybe sometime next year called Lilja Sigurðardóttir. We share the same last name. So I'm not sure. I think it's called The Trap. I would recommend that one as well.
Okay.
And yeah.
And what about something to watch?
Something to watch? Watch Trapped Series 2.
Yes.
Yeah, which will be coming, I don't know, next year probably as well. I helped them with the storyline, so I'm...
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, well, we should certainly watch some great recommendations there from Anne and Ursa, and you can find details of the books on the website. Well, that's about it for this episode of Stab in the Dark. We've learned why islands are fantastic places to set crime stories in, both on the page and on the screen, and what it's really like to live in Iceland. You can find out more about A Stab in the Dark, along with articles and some great book competitions, at uktv.co.uk/astabinthedark, or you can get in touch with us on Twitter, #astabinthedark. Oh, and don't forget to review us on your podcast app. Go on, do it now. But if you can't say something nice, don't say anything. That would be mean. So with that, it is a huge thank you to my guests, Anne Cleeves and Ursa Sigurdardottir. Oh, I messed the pronunciation. I've been doing so well, haven't I, Ursa, up until that point. And then right at the end, I'm going to try that again. A huge thank you to my guests, Anne Cleeves. And here we go. Ursa Sigurdardottir.
Ah, there you go.
And our producers, Sam Pearson and Paul Hirons. My name's Mark Billingham. And until the next episode, when I'll be back with more fantastic guests, thank you for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.